afternoon. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the author of a new book about Dolly Parton says the country singer has a lot to tell us about the lives of working women. First, President-elect Joe Biden has pledged to undo many of President Trump's immigration policies. According to the Migration Policy Institute, Trump has made more than 400 alterations to immigration policy through executive action, policy guidance, and regulatory changes. While Biden can rescind some of those measures with executive orders on day one, others would take some time, maybe even years. That means that for the foreseeable future, asylum seekers will have to keep seeking protections in a third country instead of at the U.S. border. Green cards can still be denied to immigrants who seek food stamps, and visa applications can be denied over social media posts. Plus, a court ruling on DACA puts the policy back in place, but legal questions there aren't going away. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see from the Biden administration when it comes to immigration? Do you want to see him undo as many of Trump's changes as possible? Or are there certain, maybe most measures that you hope remain in place? Do you think now at last is time for Congress to do something when it comes to immigration? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. Her areas of expertise include refugees and U.S. foreign policy. Elise, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Elise, over the last 4 years, we've talked a lot about individual policies from the Trump administration when it came to immigration and refugees and deportation and more. Big picture, how consequential has the Trump presidency been for immigration and related issues?
Yeah, that is a great question. When we look at the big picture, I think some of the more high-profile policies that come to mind are things like the travel ban. So the travel ban was the first major policy change that Trump put into place when he came into office in January of 2017. That went through several legal challenges, as listeners may recall. What we ended up with was the third iteration. So travelers from Iran, Libya, Syria, some from Venezuela and North Korea, Yemen and Somalia, that remains in effect today because it was upheld by the Supreme Court. We also saw the Remain in Mexico, or what's known as the MPP, which was put into place in early 2019. And I think that's another one that would be fresher in people's minds. It's resulted in sort of tent camps of makeshift refugee camps along the southern border as part of the administration's deterrence approach. And there's estimated over 25,000 asylum seekers and migrants that are in those camps awaiting their court hearings on the other side of the U.S.-Mexico border. We also saw some major humanitarian entry restrictions, changing asylum guidelines, very dramatic drops in the annual refugee caps. So that we're down to about 15,000 refugee for the 21 fiscal year admissions cap. And family separations was one, if listeners recall from a couple of years ago, that got a lot of pushback and media attention. So those are just some highlights.
And as we've seen in the Obama administration with DACA and the Trump administration with a lot of the things you just mentioned, some things an administration can kind of flip a switch on. Other things take time and are subject to legal challenges. So all that said, what are the kind of things that if President-elect Biden pursues immigration changes, as he says he wants to, what are the kind of things he could do on day one or month one?
Well, on day one, the travel ban is something that could more easily be undone because it was done through an executive action. It can be undone easily through Biden signing a similar executive action and resuming travel from those countries that are on the list. The Remain in Mexico or the MPP will be a little more difficult because it does involve also the Mexican government, and it's not clear what will become of those, you know, 25,000 or so asylum seekers on the other side of the border, particularly given the pandemic. Some of those asylum changes that Trump has made over the years will probably be the lengthiest and most bureaucratic in terms of undoing them because they're now so deeply embedded in procedural changes within the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security. But certainly some changes can be implemented pretty much from day one. It will just be a lengthier process. Now, with family separations, that's something that it will be interesting to see how the Biden administration approaches the calls for almost reparations to the mental health and trauma damages that were done to children, for example, that were separated from their families. So that's something that we don't really have a clear sense of how the Biden administration will approach those lawsuits from ACLU, for example, you know, demanding kind of a reparations for what the government did under that policy. I think one of the trickiest ones will probably be the border wall, because there are already contracts that have been agreed to by Trump. Some of those projects, when Biden comes in, will be almost like halfway constructed, halfway done in terms of barrier construction projects. And there could be the potential for the contractors to seek damages or settlements if the Biden administration tries to stop some of those border wall construction projects.
Talking to Elise Cohen, political scientist at UW Green Bay. She focuses on immigration, asylum, and related topics. We are talking about what the Biden administration, the incoming Biden administration, can and can't do when it comes to changing Trump administration policies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ricardo is with us in Madison. Ricardo, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Ricardo?
Yeah, I am a DACA recipient, and what I would like to see for the Biden organization to do is to now shift gears into providing DACA recipients the original piece, which is the DREAM Act. They're all capital letters, and they stand for the D stands for the development, the R stands for the relief, the E stands for education, four, and then A stands for alien, and then the M stands for minors. So the Development Relief Education for Alien Minors Act, which basically serves as a bridge from the Supreme Court ruling, Plyer versus Doe, which provides undocumented immigrants, regardless of citizenship, to get a right for education. That is the right of all children.
Ricardo, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Elise in on this. A couple parts here, Elise. First of all, Ricardo mentioned a DACA recipient himself. There was a court ruling that has a big impact, at least for now. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Yeah, so we just had this ruling about the reinstatement of DACA. And to give a little bit of context to the listeners on that, we had seen the Supreme Court already rule over this past summer in June of 2020 that the DACA did need to be reinstated and restored to its previous sort of prior to September 2017 status, which is when the Trump administration attempted to halt DACA. And so this ruling is really big for recipients for a few reasons. First of all, ICE had started looking into closed deportation cases and looking for a pathway to potentially deport DACA recipients. And this ruling means that that will now be halted. So those recipients do not need to worry immediately that they will have orders coming for their deportation. Something else that this ruling means sort of immediately is people with the protection can have it extended back to 2 years, which was the initial length of time, instead of just 1 year. So that means recipients like Ricardo would only need to apply every 2 years instead of every single year to have it renewed. The reason that I think Ricardo is bringing up this important point about something broader and more lasting is because DACA is still very temporary. It is not something that confers any legal status to the recipient. So that means DACA recipients will still be living in limbo with very precarious futures, not certain of any path to residency or lawful status beyond that 2 year renewal period. So this is where it becomes challenging, because we would actually need to see congressional legislation passed. The Biden administration will be very limited what they can do just through executive action, but we would need to see comprehensive immigration reform really address some of these issues, like a pathway to citizenship, perhaps, or at least a legal residency that would come with some of these benefits that Ricardo mentioned.
Thanks for the call, Ricardo. We're talking about the incoming Biden administration and immigration issues with Elise Cohen. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you want to change when it comes to immigration law, refugee requirements, asylum, and more under President-elect Biden? What from President Trump would you like to see stay in place? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about immigration issues facing the incoming Biden administration. Elise Cohen is our guest, associate professor of political science at UW-Green Bay, expert in refugees and U.S. foreign policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. We've got Owen with us in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, Rob. Yeah, so a couple things here. First thing is we really need to help the undocumented immigrants that are here in Wisconsin milking cows and throughout the nation that live here 365 days a year. They never go home to become citizens of this country because they already are citizens. They have residency here, and they're not allowed to participate in democracy. And that's a failure of our Constitution and a failure of the rights of the people that are here contributing to the growth domestic product of this nation. And the next thing is dairy farmers, especially the ones that are larger and want to continue to expand, they're really going to need some comprehensive immigration reform that's going to help them bring in more workers that are potentially looking for long-term employment on those farms.
Owen, thanks a lot for the call. Elise, thoughts on the status of people working here in Wisconsin in the dairy industry and what this could all mean for them?
Well, one thing that we did see based on the caller's question under Trump's administration was a drop even in the legal categories of immigration. So some of those visa categories that might cover seasonal agricultural workers, it wasn't a huge drop. The latest I saw was around 7% or so in the legal immigration drop under Trump. And that is something that the Biden administration could potentially tackle right away in increasing the number of visas that are given for those kinds of jobs. The other part of what your caller there is mentioning in terms of a pathway to status and protection beyond what they have, again, that's something where I think we would have to see congressional agreement, and we would need to see that gain some kind of bipartisan consensus in order to have that on a more permanent basis.
Thanks for the call, Owen. We'll go to Trish next in Milwaukee. Trish, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Trish?
I just wanted to bring up that the United States of America is a country, and we should have borders. And if people are coming into our country illegally, then they need to go back and come in legally, like all of our other ancestors. As for the DACA recipients, I understand they were children. They had no choice. So for those particular people, yes, they need a pathway to citizenship, and they all need to come on board with that. And hopefully the Biden administration can do something with that. But I think our border wall still needs to continue, and I think we need to also support ICE.
Trish, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there to work with, Elise. First of all, the need for people to enter the country legally, there are fewer paths over the last 4 years, I think, to do that. Can you talk about what it would take to have secure borders but provide avenues for people to enter legally?
Absolutely. And that's another great point where we can see Biden in his campaign rhetoric was still very much talking about border security. And if we look back at his campaign website, which I studied really closely in this last election, we can find that he talked a lot about border security, the importance of having technology and surveillance and screening. So absolutely, Biden is not one that would call for open borders or borderlessness. And I think this other point that the caller raises about undocumented and, you know, legal or illegal status, that's where we might see the asylum seekers have an opening up of what qualifies as asylum, because the Trump administration did make some restrictions there, getting rid of, for example, gang violence and domestic violence as eligibility to qualify for asylum. So those could be some potential ways that we can see people have more legal paths into the country while still maintaining the Biden promise of border security.
Trish, thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. I think Yoel is with us in Superior. Yoel, hi.
Yes, hi. I just want to say that I agree with Trish. The number one reason Donald Trump won in 2016, I think it was because of the immigration issue. Border security is something that people of all demographic, whether you're black, Hispanic, white, can agree on. We need strong border security. And one thing, one other thing that I want to say is H-1B visa. I think the H-1B visa needs to end immediately because I don't believe that foreign immigrants should come in here and take jobs from everyday Americans, high-paying jobs.
Yoel, thanks a lot for the call. Let's, in our last minute or two, focus on that second point, H-1B visas we haven't talked about yet, Elise.
Yes, and that's for specialty occupations. So some of the high-skilled visas that the Trump administration was restricting in the last year, that's something that the Biden administration could pretty quickly tackle in terms of increasing those. As your caller says, there are concerns about how that will factor into our labor market as it is. And I think this is one of the constraints for the Biden administration is while we are still having economic troubles related to the pandemic, there will probably be pressure to wait on some of those expansions until we are in sort of a post-vaccine reality with the economy opening up and the labor market having more of those niches that need to be met. So, yes, I think absolutely we're going to see debates among the more liberal aspects and more centrist aspects of the Democratic Party over what to do and how quickly on that.
I've seen arguments, Elise, that the people brought in on H-1B visas often end up being job creators in entrepreneurship or for the industries they work for. Do we have data on that kind of thing?
Absolutely. That's something that's often contested, but there's a lot of data that suggests that they are creating jobs for native-born Americans as well. So those that are in favor of expanding them, as the Biden approach has historically been at least indicated in his rhetoric, would say it's a source of a stimulus for the economy to have that. So, yeah, I'll be watching that carefully to see kind of the debates that are going to unfold, not just in terms of the economics of it, but pushes for sort of the humanitarian aspect, seeing these people not just as economic stimulants, but also as people.
Elise, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
It was great to be with you, Rob.
Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. We talked to her today about what the incoming Biden administration may do about DACA, the border wall, and a whole lot of other immigration issues. In coming weeks, healthcare workers in Wisconsin will start getting vaccinated against COVID-19. It's a hopeful sign after months of grim news about the pandemic. But as Shemaine Mills reports, the vaccine won't be widely available until spring or summer, and that means the health risks to Wisconsinites from the ongoing pandemic are far from over.
What some have called salvation in a syringe can't come soon enough for Dr. Neil Bard, who still remembers the fear of polio during an outbreak in the 1950s.
People got paralyzed from polio. I remember being taken by my parents, rushed to the local elementary school, and couldn't wait for the public health nurse to get us vaccinated.
Bard is medical director at Richland Hospital Clinic in southwestern Wisconsin. He says looking ahead to a vaccine can't lead people to drop pandemic safety guidelines now.
We have to be vigilant. We have to watch for any kind of increase that might overwhelm our ability to care for people.
Richland Center is a small city of 5,000 where vehicles stop for pedestrians even when there's no stop sign or crosswalk. This consideration of others doesn't always carry over to mask wearing during the pandemic, which Bard says has become a political flashpoint. More than a dozen people have died from COVID in Richland County since the pandemic began. To deal with a surge of cases, hospitals around the state are making extra space for beds, treating those with milder COVID symptoms at home, and relying on each other to take patients they can't care for. Even before the pandemic, smaller hospitals routinely transferred patients to bigger hospitals that can provide more advanced care. As Bard talks, a medical helicopter buzzes overhead.
MedFlight, they'll land on the top of the hospital to take a patient from here out.
Some have avoided hospitalization with COVID treatments, and a vaccine is on the way. Lisa Johnson is CEO of BioForward Wisconsin. The trade group represents science companies, some of which were involved in the making of COVID-19 tests and treatments.
We're in a different age now where we have machine learning, AI, all of this can unlock the genome much, much faster than when they were trying to create a vaccine for polio or the measles. It's just exciting.
But the challenges ahead are daunting. Distribution and persuading the public to get vaccinated. Every year, the U.S. falls short of its goal, convincing 70% of Americans to get a seasonal flu shot. So far, only 37% of people in Wisconsin have been vaccinated against influenza. In Richland Center, Bart is optimistic because the clinic has given more flu shots this year than ever before. He hopes it's the same for a COVID-19 vaccine when it becomes widely available.
And I'm hoping that it's going to be like 1958 polio vaccine, that people will be clamoring for this. I've already had patients who I give flu shot to, and they said, tell me when the big one is here, because I want it.
Even with the finish line in sight, the last stretch of a long race can be the most difficult. Bard and other health professionals say people still have to keep their guard up against a disease that shows no signs of letting up. National health officials have warned the most brutal part of the pandemic lies ahead, that stretch when infections are still spreading and a vaccine isn't widely available yet. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the life and work of Dolly Parton and how she's represented working women throughout her career with the author of a new book about Dolly Parton. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, if you're getting ready to hunker down for the winter in a weird year, this is a good conversation for you. Kate Archer-Kent talks to the author of the book, Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, here's a bit of an American classic.
They let you dream just to watch them shatter. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. Come in and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting.
Yes, it's 9 to 5 by legendary country musician and actor Dolly Parton. Parton's been a fixture in American country and pop culture for decades, and her image has evolved over the years. For many people, she's been a feminist icon, even if she doesn't use the term herself. In her new book, our next guest takes a look at the life of Dolly Parton, her music, and the working women who saw themselves in her songs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a Dolly Parton fan, going way back or just recently, what does she mean to you? How has she represented women in her music? What songs by Dolly Parton stick with you, say something to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Sarah Smarsh is a journalist and author. Her new book is She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, it's good to be with you.
Well, I think recently there's been this, you know, in recent years, this explosion of interest and affection for Dolly Parton, just sort of generically, yeah, she's pretty cool. In her book, you really dig into, in your book, you really dig into what made her what she is today. And a lot of that is the messages she had for working women, for low income women. Can you talk about how that's at the heart of her work and why she speaks to her fans?
Sure. So as you said, Dolly is certainly having a moment, and this for a woman who has been in the music industry for half a century at this point, it's rare and interesting to see kind of living legend receive this new regard and a kind of reconsideration of what she represents. And I think part of that is understanding the complexity and layers under her physical presentation and the persona that everyone knows and perhaps sometimes glossed over as somehow superficial or over the top. And one component of that, one of those layers that is incredibly important to me as a daughter of the rural working class, is her roots, where she comes from, and her affinity and abiding love for her place and her class and people. That's a class and people that broader society and certainly the successful circles in which she now resides would encourage her to feel ashamed of. And she has instead always come full circle to her home through her storytelling, through the way that she continues to present herself as a product of her place and just the vernacular, the her form of speech, even the clothes that she chooses to wear. You know, I say sometimes she's a smart woman with a lot of money. She could have classed herself up a long time ago. And I find that her decision not to is a little bit of a statement, maybe a covert one that was missed by folks who were distracted by her physicality in the earlier decades of her career.
We'll dig more into that, but I want to meet another key character in your book. This is a personal book for you, and in part, it's because of your grandma, Betty, who I think at age, when you were 11, took you to see Dolly Parton. Talk about Dolly Parton through the eyes of Grandma Betty.
Sure. Well, Dolly Parton and my grandmother are almost precise contemporaries, so my grandma was born just a few months apart from Dolly, and they were born into quite similar circumstances. My grandmother in poverty in Kansas, so a different region geographically, but there were certainly parallels. They also were both, frankly, blonde women who met sort of standards of beauty for their time and therefore received a particular sort of attention that sometimes was positive, but also sometimes was degrading. And this was at a moment and in decades when the women's movement of the 1970s hadn't happened yet. And there were very few policy-based protections for women in poverty, women of any class, certainly. But for a woman in a rural space and with very few economic resources, there was a vulnerability that could be dangerous and even deadly. Dolly Parton writes about that in her early songs, many of which are dark Appalachian melodies that bear witness to the plight of poor rural women. Dolly herself escaped a lot of those fates, be they domestic violence or unsupported pregnancies and so on. My grandmother Betty did not. She lived a lot of the songs that Dolly Parton wrote, and I saw the connection that she felt with Dolly Parton, the songwriter, in those moments when we were, you know, rolling down a two-lane highway. My grandma puts a tape in the tape deck in the 1980s, and Dolly Parton sings. My grandmother would sometimes cry, and this is in the context of frankly, not a very emotive or expressive culture. I was born into the rural German Catholic Midwestern farming community that is, there are just a lot of layers of sort of you are stoic and you don't complain and you certainly don't shed a tear for your own misfortunes. And yet when Dolly Parton sang of those misfortunes, I saw that my grandma Betty experienced a sense of validation that I knew even as a child was extremely rare in popular culture. Country music was really the only place that I saw women like my grandma afforded any real dignity.
That's another point you make right off the bat. Country music is one of the few genres that I think people will just dismiss completely out of hand. You say maybe sometimes people will do it with rap as well. You talk about how, especially for women, country music is like the only part of pop culture sometimes that speaks to their lives.
Absolutely. And, you know, I couldn't have articulated this as a kid, but now as a member of the media industry and someone who writes books and has a hand in, you know, and has the privilege of helping shape the sorts of narratives that follow national discourse, I see now the absolute dearth of stories and voices who have any direct connection to the place that I come from. So country music, and probably not coincidentally, because it is dignifying the voices of specifically poor rural women, often more specifically poor rural white women. But at any rate, it is a demographic that has precious few ambassadors in society and culture. And perhaps for that reason, because it does the work of dignifying that space that is often vilified or negatively stereotyped in broader terms, it is dismissed out of hand as a silly art form, when in fact it can be and often is, and certainly in Dolly Parton's case, a very sophisticated genre.
Talking to Sarah Smarsh, her new book is She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a fan, old or new, of Dolly Parton, or if you have a question for our guest, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Sarah, you talk a lot about women at this time and from this background working in a man's world, whether that's Grandma Betty, I think, working at a law firm with some very, I think, sexist lawyers, or Dolly Parton coming into the country music industry, the very male-dominated industry. Can you talk a little bit about Dolly Parton's experience in the early days in that world?
Sure. So I was born in 1980, which is the same year that song you played, introducing the segment, 9 to 5, came out that same year as did the blockbuster movie of the same name. And so in many ways, I'm kind of the daughter of the 9 to 5 generation, the woman who put on the shoulder pads and the high heels, and they entered the workforce in new ways and in new spaces, in large part due to Title IX legislation in the late 1970s that afforded them more protections for their gender in professional capacity. And my grandmother was one of those women. She started as what at the time they would have called secretary at the courthouse in downtown Wichita. She'd make these long drives from out in the country for this job, which was the first one she'd ever held that didn't require just backbreaking manual labor, which was what she was born into. She kind of worked herself up the ladder so far as she could without a college degree, and ended up as a bailiff and a probation officer under a county judge. And so for me, witnessing her enter that space where indeed she was surrounded by more privileged people, attorneys, as you mentioned, people who didn't have direct experience of poverty. All the same, she had sort of entered a world where, in theory at least, while she certainly faced sexual discrimination and harassment, she had an opportunity to make a decent and livable wage on her wits and her skills. She had spent most of her life, you know, waiting tables in diners and working in factories. And at that same moment, there were myriad parallels for women across the country. And for Dolly Parton, that moment happened to coincide with her, just the moment when she was coming into her own as a solo artist. So she had spent much of the 70s as the co-star to a huge country music star named Porter Wagoner on a show that bore his name. And yet she often kind of outshone him as a star. She was a better writer, a better singer, and soon the audience loved her more than they loved him. And so when she struck out on her own in the late 70s, it was just building up to that moment when women would have more opportunity than they had previously. And it was just like perfect timing and Kairos with her own brilliance and genius available to offer the songwriting and the voice that in previous decades might not have been heard.
We're talking to Sarah Smarsh right now. Her new book is She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you see Dolly Parton's role in popular culture? Do you have a favorite song you'd like to share, a story maybe about seeing Dolly Parton perform live? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
She has so many faces. She wears so many names. She goes so many places and she does so many things. 'Cause she's a working girl.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's Working Girl by Dolly Parton. We're talking to Sarah Smarsh, author of the book She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ben is with us in Watertown. Ben, hi.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Ben?
Well, I'm a big fan, and I really like Jolene. I do remember, though, sometimes you see these old Johnny Carson shows on TV channels, and she's a guest on there. And they're obviously making fun of, in a kind of a snide way, of her sexuality. And she really seemed to move beyond that. I just wondered how she did that and beyond being considered kind of a sex symbol or, I don't know how to phrase it delicately, but, you know what mm-hmm. I mean.
Yeah, Ben, thanks for the call. And, Sarah, you tell just cringe-inducing stories of Dolly Parton on Johnny Carson, Barbara Walters, Oprah Winfrey, and more. We could spend a lot of time talking about this, but what do you have to say to Ben?
Well, thanks, Ben, for the question and the comment. It's absolutely apt, and it's at the heart of why I ever even wrote this book, which is in those interviews that you might see replayed from earlier decades of her career where an otherwise famously dignified interviewer such as Johnny Carson even himself lowers himself to a sort of sly belittling of her by way of, making a comment like, I'd love to see under your blouse and that sort of thing. And my hope with this book is to kind of talk about all the things that those interviewers weren't asking her about and should have been. As for how she navigated that particularly sexist treatment, there are a couple of ways, and there's some a radical nature to it, I think, certainly for her generation. One is that she didn't cover herself up and attempt to, downplay her femininity or sexuality. In fact, she went quite in the opposite direction. She understood that she was being turned into a sexual object, and she embraced it in a sense by wearing low-cut clothes and sort of making jokes about the size of her breasts that before a male interviewer could do the same. And then simultaneously with that, she just kept putting out incredible work. Occasionally it was a memorable role in a movie, but far more often it involved her songwriting and performing. And the just absolutely obvious genius in her work forced people then to reconcile the stereotypes that they had about a woman who looked like her, which is that she must be, a dumb blonde, quote unquote, forced them to reconcile those sorts of stereotypes with the deeper, very meaningful layers of who she was underneath all of that. So it was in many ways what today we would call a gender performance, decades before there was any consideration of that idea in the mainstream.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard in Dave from Middleton, who says he'd like to hear what the guest has to say about Dolly Parton's efforts to promote literacy and books for kids. And Sarah, I'll say my wife works in the library world. I said, doing an interview about this book about Dolly Parton. And she's like, Dolly Parton's a legend in the library world for her work on this. And you write about a lot of Dolly Parton's philanthropy over the years. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I'm happy to speak to this, particularly as a book person myself, obviously. Dolly Parton is famously generous and philanthropic in all sorts of ways. Most notably in recent headlines, she gave $1 million to Vanderbilt University for development of a COVID-19 treatment, which resulted in the Moderna vaccine in part that will, do no less than save the world, I guess. So Dolly Parton has her hands in that. But her number one cause for many decades has been literacy, and specifically by way of children. The reason is she was raised by a father who was extremely brilliant, but also illiterate, just for lack of schooling or opportunity to learn to read and write. And she founded an organization called the Imagination Library, which for decades now has given to any family who applies one free book per month from birth to age 5 for young children around the world. And I believe that they recently crossed the notable milestone of 150 million books given away, incredibly enough. And so that's a cause that is near and dear to her heart. And that endears her to me all the more as someone who cares very much about books and coming from a poor rural space knows the transformative power that they hold.
Talking to Sarah Smarsh, her new book is She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. Back to your calls now. Russ is with us in Stoughton. Russ, hi.
Hi. Amazing coincidence that you're doing Dolly Parton today. Just last night, well, early this morning, WPR plugs into the BBC broadcasting for late night, and they did a segment on Dolly Parton. I didn't get in at the beginning. I think they might have been interviewing Lily Tomlin. It sounded like her, but I never heard that. But one fact that came out is that Dolly Parton wrote the song 9 to 5 on the set between rehearsals. That was not an original part of the movie to be included, but it did get included because she wrote it and it became so popular.
Russ, thanks a lot for the call. Well, that's, I think, a good excuse, Sarah, to talk about Dolly Parton as an amazing musician and obviously songwriter. We could, again, talk for a long time just about this, but share your thoughts on Dolly Parton, musician.
Sure. Well, she thinks of herself, to the caller's point, she thinks of herself as a songwriter first in terms of her kind of creative engine. Her performing and all the rest come second. And she's quite prolific. She has written over 3,000 songs over the decades. Many of those have been covered by all sorts of famous musicians from, you know, Whitney Houston and onward. But as far as her writing that song for 9 to 5, I think, is a perfect springboard for examining this particular creative genius of Dolly Parton, because Lily Tomlin might have been telling the BBC, as Jane Fonda, their other co-star on 9 to 5, has also told the story in documentaries of Dolly Parton taking her long acrylic fingernails and using them, you know, kind of scratching them up against one another for a sort of washboard effect. And that's that sound that you hear that's sort of typewriter-esque at the beginning of 9 to 5. She used that sound to, and, you know, she's tapping into that sense of connecting with a typewriter for the working women represented in that film. And this song just then kind of flowed out of her. And Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin both talk about having been struck by, you know, she runs it past them and they say, you know, they got goosebumps just realizing how she had done that off the cuff and sensing that it was going to be a big hit. And of course, it remains a big hit today. I think probably one of the most recognizable songs from the 20th century.
Well, Sarah, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us. This flew right past.
Thanks, Rob.
We've been talking to Sarah Smarsh, journalist and author. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. Well, if you have a Dolly Parton memory to share, favorite song you want to tell us about, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email. It's ideas@WPR.org. If you're a Dolly Parton fan of longstanding or recent convert. Again, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, families count on the holidays for special time with their older relatives, but that can put vulnerable people at risk during this pandemic. Our guest has advice on staying in touch with seniors in our family and for seniors to stay connected themselves. We'll get the latest from WisConText on the recent COVID-19 surge in Wisconsin, where in the state it's happening, and how it's affecting the healthcare system. And on Food Friday, a cookbook author has a simple message for us. Let's brunch. We'll get some great advice for that magical meal that's not quite breakfast, not quite lunch. That and a look at the Facebook lawsuits out there, that and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Earlier this week, we talked about a growing market for secondhand clothing in thrift stores, vintage stores, online, and more. You called in with your stories, and some more of you shared your experiences on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dee Dee writes, I grew up with hand-me-downs, wore clothes till threadbare. My mom had friends with good taste. We'd get to pick through piles of wonderful clothes my single mom never could have afforded new. Cassandra says, I grew up on secondhand clothes. I'm a seamstress, and I would look for ones that had good fabric, still enough to take apart the item, and use my homemade patterns to make clothes for me. And Cassandra says, I still do that for quilts. Jocelyn says to secondhand clothes, why not? As long as it's something you can wash before wearing, there's some pretty cool finds out there. Many things are almost like new. James writes, this has been a bit of a trend for a few years now. Macklemore and Ryan Lewis did their thrift shop song 8 years ago. Thrift shopping can be awesome. And Brandy writes, I buy new clothes and buy secondhand. After all, they're new to me. You can keep sharing your secondhand stories, maybe a picture of your favorite find over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.